From Iowa to New Jersey, Florida to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, immigrants, legal and illegal, send billions of dollars in remittances each year back to their old country. Enemies of America are using this as a form of economic warfare. Ammon Blair of the Texas Public Policy Foundation is here to explain. It is National School Choice Week. Students and parents have some exciting new funding options. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The protests in Minneapolis have given rise to questions about constitutional rights. Eric Boehm and Billy Binion of Reason Magazine are here to bring clarity. And President Donald Trump once again used bluster and threats, but he did achieve his goal of getting the United States greater access to Greenland. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Known as remittances, they are money immigrants send back to their country of origin. But some of those nations are using remittances as a form of economic warfare that imperils our national security. Here with details is Ammon Blair. He is a former U.S. Army officer and Border Patrol agent who is now a senior fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Ammon, welcome to American Radio Journal. When we think about immigration, we think about it in a number of terms. And you recently had an op-ed piece that you wrote, and you talked about remittances and the flow of dollars out of the United States into other countries. Do you want to explain for us what you mean by that, and then we can talk about the implications?
When we have foreign nationals that seek to, quote-unquote, migrate into the United States by other means, or illegally into the U.S., either through the asylum process, refugee process, or just illegally between the ports of entry, a majority of them are actually not asylees or refugees. They're seeking better economic conditions in a safer environment. So the millions and millions of people that came across into the border are now here and have occupied every single state. But they also have family members back home. And so they'll typically, whether they're working in the underworld, whether it's licitly or illicitly, they tend to send their money back home. So here's the issue, is that a single person doing so is not so much a problem unless they're completely tied to a foreign terrorist organization. But when you do that at such a scale that it equates to hundreds of billions of dollars per year out of our economy, assisting the economies of other nation states, sometimes adversarial nation states, then you seem to wonder, why is it that millions of people have actually come across our border and now are inside the United States? And so when you look at this and you look at how much of remittances other countries are in need of or using, you'll see like El Salvador's roughly over 20% of their GDP is from remittances. Somalia is about 25% of their GDP. You'll start to see why many nation states actually allow the outward flow of their citizens to the U.S. Like you'll see during the Biden administration, the Panama, the Darien Gap, you'll see all these countries that not only do they not stop it, but they'll work with international NGOs to help facilitate it to come to the U.S. And the reason being is it's economic coercion. You know, they're sending their greatest export. They no longer have to deal with their citizens inside their country, and they can now become an operational tool and a financial asset in a foreign nation. And so many nations will do this, and what it does is also provide that nation a direct access to our local economy, our states, and our nation. And so if you were an adversary, if you were, say, like China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea, or any other of our enemies, then this would be a means in which you could send thousands upon thousands of your citizens into a country, live in a diaspora, and also have them as an operational tool for like the CCP, using them as espionage, other forms of cyber attacks from within the United States, or drug warfare through narcotics. Then you'll see that nation states are going to utilize this to not only destabilize our regions inside the United States, but also reap massive amounts of financial gain.
It would seem this touches on several areas of immigration and financial law here, Amin. Are there any plans currently before Congress? Do we even need legislation, or is this something that can be administratively done to tighten up on the flow of these remittances out of the United States and into foreign nations?
There are bills both at the federal level and also at the state level. You know, states can also tax remittances, but when you view it, as opposed to just viewing it as, hey, this is just one family sending money to another, this needs to be investigated by our intelligence community, as many of these remittances at scale are tied to nation states utilizing them, that are utilizing them for their adversarial or opportunities for them to conduct their operations globally, and then also conduct gray zone conflict or campaigns against the United States. These funds are also utilized by foreign terrorist organizations such as Al-Shabaab, Mexican cartels, Cartel of the Suns, you name it, MS-13. All these organizations have tapped into the entire supply chain of remittances to utilize for also their wars overseas and also their operations inside the United States. So the remittance thing not only needs to be either taxed, needs to be looked at, but it needs to be completely transparent and held accountable of where this is going, who is utilizing the funds, leaving out, but more importantly, why is it that we are allowing all these foreign nationals inside the United States to extract hundreds of billions of dollars each year to supply and support failing third world countries?
If you have an immigrant who is in the United States illegally, how do they circumvent existing financial regulations to even get that money out of the country?
Yeah, great question. The same ways and means that the Mexican cartels launder their money. They launder their money through outside means. They usually use money services or money banks, as well as Chinese-owned banks. And then there's also cryptocurrency. So there are many forms now. So like even if we clamp down on our banking systems, just like the cartels would do or any other organization, since a lot of it is also funded to them, they're just going to go outside those means and find out a separate way or a parallel path to extract the dollars from the foreign nationals inside the United States to their organizations globally. So really, at the end of the day, you're going to have to start investigating the massive networks and mapping them out inside the United States of all the nation states and also all the terrorist organizations, smuggling organizations, and transnational criminal organizations that are utilizing these funds.
We have been talking with Amin Blair, who is a senior fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Amin, tell us a bit about the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Also, we'd like to have your website so folks can read up on this.
We are the largest conservative think tank at the state-based level. We focus specifically on liberty items. My campaign is a secure and sovereign nation, where we focus on all things homeland defense, homeland security, to include border security and immigration at the state level and at the national level. Your folks can reach us at texaspolicy.com, or you can follow me at Amin S. Blair on Twitter.
Amin Blair of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Amin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. It has been a while since we've talked about school choice and education freedom and related issues. There have been some major developments. And Scott, it's School Choice Week.
That's right, Loman.
In honor of School Choice Week, let's talk a bit about some changes that have taken place at the federal level. Really big news for giving parents and students school choice options. Can you fill us in on the details?
It's one of those things that school choice has always been an issue that I think people have been thinking about and wondering, you know, can legislatures get it done? What is the federal government going to do about it? And I think during the COVID era, that a lot of parents' eyes were opened when we forced kids into remote learning, really about the low quality K through 12 education that their children were receiving, and a lot of the woke issues that were directly happening inside of the classroom. And so it created this parents' rights movement. It was super big, I think, all across the country. And that created the political climate for dozens and dozens of state legislatures to advance school choice legislation. And the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that we've talked about several times also included probably the most robust school choice provision in federal government history, as they passed the ECCA bill into the reconciliation legislation. And what that does is it allows individuals to contribute to what are known as scholarship granting organizations. And these SGOs can receive $1,700 contribution from an individual, and then they can total up all this money and they can award scholarships to kids that are seeking school choice or higher or better educational opportunities and the K through 12 level. This isn't just for private schools or for homeschooling. It can also be for after school activities with the public school. Imagine if you needed assistance to pay for tutors. And so there's hundreds of these SGOs that are lined up all throughout the country. And right now, the U.S. Treasury Department is undergoing the rulemaking and clarification process for what exactly the statute of the ECCA means from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. There are questions like, imagine if you're a married couple, do you get a $1,700 tax credit, or does it exceed up to $3,400 because there's joint filers? That's actually a major issue that they're still reconciling. Then there's other questions about the percentages that the SGO has to award to scholarships compared to administrative costs and overhead expenses. There's a lot of questions, I think, about which states are going to be opting in. And if you're an SGO, let's say, in a state that has opted in, a big red state like Montana, what is that going to do if the SGO wants to operate in a blue state that is not participating? You know, we know that there's millions of people in California that want to receive school choice, but it's a blue state with a blue legislature. And I don't anticipate Governor Newsom actually opting into the law. So can a state like Arizona, who has robust school choice, can they use an SGO there to help kids in California? These are all questions that I think are being navigated right now. The good news is National School Choice Week has sort of highlighted the need for these governors to opt in. And I think there's been a good coordination from the White House and the Department of Education, led by Linda McMahon, and then other big school choice activists that are working toward encouraging these governors to opt in. The Club for Growth is also a part of that coalition. And we've already had 25 governors opt into that program, and only three have said that they will not participate. If you say you're not going to participate, that's an annual decision. So imagine the state that gets a new red governor after 2026. In theory, they could go ahead and opt in for 2027 if the governor-elect decided to. So there's a lot happening in the school choice movement. I think it's a good thing for parents and students, and obviously anybody that cares about educating the next generation of contributors to the economy.
It would appear that opting in here, Scott, would be a real no-brainer. What would be the political pressure on these blue state governors to not opt into a program like this?
Well, I don't think I'm going to surprise you with this answer, but I think it's the teachers' unions. Those folks are incredibly worried that school choice is going to pinch public school educators out of their jobs. But what it actually does is it creates choice and competition in the educational marketplace. We know that it's important to put that pressure on educators and make sure that dollars follow the backpack and not just educational bureaucracies. That's what I think state legislatures are focused on for the most part, ensuring that these dollars that are given to schools at least have some level of a checkoff program or parental involvement to decide how the money is spent. you know, there's a lot of rural areas that rely on public education, and they're totally satisfied with what their children are receiving. But imagine if your zip code is 53913 or 89128, and you can move it by a couple of digits and move to a school that is actually better for your child. And that's what this whole program is about, making sure that we have scholarships that can give these kids opportunities.
Let's take a little bit of a side detour here before we end, Scott. We've been trying to keep track of key U.S. Senate and congressional races around the country. I understand there's been a major development in an open seat in Texas.
Well, you remember Texas did redistricting several months ago, and that created five new Republican congressional districts that should be pickup opportunities. One of them is in the Houston area, and it's the 9th district of Texas. This week, Club for Growth PAC announced its endorsement of Alex Miller. Alex is a military veteran, defused bombs in Afghanistan, and got her MBA JD from Harvard University. She has a career in finance and energy, and we think that she will be an incredibly productive, conservative, and candidate that supports free market economic policies. We're thrilled to be supporting her candidacy. This was the Al Green district, and he got so nervous about losing that he moved over to the 18th district of Texas.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in those ideas of economic freedom and liberty. School choice is one of the big issues that we work on every single day. And if you want to learn more about the other policies or our school choice posture, you can visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, greatly appreciate your being with us. Take care.
You're welcome.
Anti-ICE protests in Minnesota have given rise to questions about the First and Second Amendment constitutional rights of protesters. Eric Boehm and Billy Binion are here to explain.
The awful and unnecessary killing of Alex Preddy by Border Patrol agents in Minneapolis on Saturday is a story with a lot of different angles. It's a story about the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. It's a story about lawful policing and protesting. It is also just genuinely a tragedy, but I think it's also a very important story about the Second Amendment, and that's the part that I want to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Billy Binion. He's a colleague of mine at Reason. You can find his writing at Reason.com, and you might have spotted him on CNN this week, where he was talking to Jake Tapper about this exact same issue. So, Billy, we appreciate you making some time for us as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is, again, very important story. I imagine by now most people have seen the video of Alex Preddy's killing, or have at least been following the story of what went on there. But I want to start by asking you to just kind of walk us through the lead up to the shooting, because if we're going to talk about this as a Second Amendment issue, obviously it's important to note that Preddy was armed, and what happened between when this sort of confrontation began and when he was killed.
Yeah, so Alex Preddy was filming law enforcement during filming Border Patrol during operation in Minneapolis, after which point I believe he and two others walked away. And it seems based on the footage that one agent followed someone he was with, a woman, and it's hard to figure out exactly what happened, but that agent ends up shoving the woman. And that to me is kind of the point where the interaction was kind of doomed. Kind of descends into chaos at that point, and Alex Preddy kind of tries to get in the middle of a scuffle between an agent and this woman. The agent ends up spraying everyone, and then a group of about five agents tackle him to the ground, and someone disarms him. There may have been some sort of accidental discharge, and then an agent shoots Preddy, and then I think nine shots follow from that. So that is kind of the backdrop of the footage that we have now.
I've seen some conservatives, not all of them, but some suggest that Preddy was looking to harm officers or somehow engaged in violent conduct here. We've seen some members of the Trump administration say that. That seems completely ridiculous to me. I've also seen others suggest that merely carrying a gun and bringing ammo to a protest somehow means that the Second Amendment no longer applies to him. Can you just clarify what the Second Amendment does and doesn't allow when it comes to being armed at a protest like this?
Sure. So I'll start at your first point. I mean, there seemed to be a coordinated talking point that we heard verbatim, literally, from multiple different government officials, from Kristi Noem to Gregory Bovino, the Border Patrol chief at least he was the Border Patrol chief. His job seems to potentially be in jeopardy. But the quote exactly was that the footage showed he was trying to massacre law enforcement, and then all this footage came out that seemed to completely contradict that. Whatever you think of the shooting, even if you still think it was justified, there is no indication from the footage that he was trying to massacre anyone. So that's, I think, a good point to start with. But yes, I mean, even further, from Donald Trump to Cash Patel, people have come out and said that there is no Second Amendment right to have a gun at a protest, you know, that there is no Second Amendment right, or people have implied there is no Second Amendment right to have a gun near law enforcement. I mean, I'll say the same thing again. Even if you think at the end of the day that this tragic shooting was justified, that is totally legally illiterate. There is no case law that says that the Second Amendment magically vanishes when police are nearby. The case law on the topic says that it's about the totality of the circumstances. So someone would have to evaluate, a court would have to evaluate what else, the full picture, what else is going on around him. And I do think it's important for people to know that that talking point is false, that the Second Amendment vanishes, because, I mean, it's troubling to hear that from an administration that has kind of claimed over and over again to be absolutist on that subject, and I would hope that the top law enforcement officers in this country know the law at a basic level.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point there, I mean, it's also kind of shocking to hear this from conservatives. And again, not all of them, not like this is not in unison. But I mean, for many conservatives, when you at least assume that that's the sort of segment of American political society that would more strongly appreciate the Second Amendment and stand up for it, we're seeing that kind of eroded away. We're talking with Billy Binion from Reason Magazine about the unfortunate events in Minneapolis this past weekend and about some of the constitutional issues at play here. Billy, I know you've also talked about the First Amendment issues here too, and we've got a minute left, so I want to touch on that before we let you go. Before all of this unfolded, and while he was carrying that gun, Alex Preti was recording law enforcement. And again, we've seen some administration officials and conservatives in general suggest that that was in some way impeding law enforcement. Give us your sense of what the Constitution and the important case law says about that.
Sure. So seven federal circuits have already ruled that the First Amendment protects your right to film law enforcement on the job, which, I mean, common sense would dictate, right? These people are funded with our taxpayer dollars. It's a form of basic accountability. I see a lot of people, you know, both pundits and powerful government officials, conflating that with violence, which violence is obviously wrong. No serious person is going to defend that, and violence is notably already a crime. You know, there are different criminal acts that are violent, and the government can and does and should prosecute those acts, but merely filming law enforcement, people should know, is their right. I mean, it is a very basic First Amendment right to hold your government employees to account so long as you are not harming them. And there is nothing, Christy Noem says a lot, you know, that filming law enforcement is a form of doxing. I mean, words have meaning. It's not violence. It is not doxing. It is your First Amendment right, and it certainly does not make you, quote, a domestic terrorist.
Yeah, your First Amendment rights don't end when the cops show up or the immigration cops show up, and neither do your Second Amendment rights. I think that's important to just keep saying as we sort through the complicated and awful circumstances here. Billy, thank you for walking us through all that.
Thanks for having me.
And that is Billy Binion. He's a reporter at Reason, where he covers criminal justice, civil liberties, and government accountability issues, all of which I think we covered here today. Check out his work online, of course, at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Donald Trump's unique and usually effective negotiating style was on display in the recent dust-up over Greenland. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, walks us through the process on this American Radio Journal commentary.
We've had a brutal week of weather in western Pennsylvania. For me, it actually hit last Friday. My wife and several of our kids made the annual trip to the March for Life in Washington, D.C. on a bus from our local parish. The whole event always has a penitential feel, especially with the January weather, which sometimes is downright frightening, and especially this time. When they arrived home at nearly midnight, the temperature was -6, with a feels like -15. But it's a funny thing about surviving weather like that. You get conditioned, assuming you learn the lesson of putting on multiple layers of clothes from head to toe. So when Snowmageddon hit the last weekend, I felt surprisingly fine snow blowing the driveway multiple times. In fact, when I put the chickens to bed at 11 p.m. on Saturday night, I can honestly say that I marveled and enjoyed the serenity of the surroundings. There was a pleasant hush in the world. Changing topics, though sticking to cold places, I wish I had the same serenity about surviving the Donald Trump chaos in Greenland the last few weeks. I vented about Trump saber-rattling in the Western Hemisphere on recent talk shows and in columns. I expressed my angst about the insanity of Trump's rhetoric toward Greenland and the horrid prospect of a seeming American land war, possibly, against fellow NATO troops in Greenland. Trump smoked off an unhinged dispatch to Norway's leader that he CC'd to every U.S. embassy in Europe. It said this, quote, "Considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8+ wars, I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace, although it will always be predominant, but can now think about what is good and proper for the United States of America," unquote. Sheesh. And for good measure, Trump threatened, quote, "We're going to take Greenland, one way or the other," unquote. Whoa, what? What in the world was Donald Trump trying to do? Could you imagine having a son in the U.S. military who might be ordered to shoot our allies in Greenland because of this president? As I express my opinions about this on air and in print, blasting Trump as a bloviating, obnoxious, you know what, more than one Trump supporter urged me to calm down and remember that Trump explodes like this frequently, as I should know by now. It's a tactic, and often successful. As my colleague Scott McKay wrote at the American Spectator, quote, "The Greenlandic diplomatic adventure is a classic example of the president's deal-making modus operandi at work. He asks for the moon when his aims are for far less. He rattles sabers in cages in order to get attention. He creates a crisis in order to force his counterpart to engage with him. When his secret terms are met, he agrees to them, and then he proceeds to shower his counterparties with praise," unquote. Indeed, Trump long ago telegraphed his tactic of starting a negotiation with an outlandish position and then working backward to get the best deal that he can. He wrote this in Art of the Deal, "I aim very high, and then I just keep pushing and pushing and pushing to get what I'm after. Sometimes I settle for less than I sought, but in most cases, I still end up with what I want." Trump advised in the book that people should think big, maximize options, fight back very hard, and he even said that, quote, "the real excitement is playing the game." The man enjoys the fight in the Art of the Deal, whether in New York with real estate or in the White House dealing with issues as diverse as tariffs in Greenland. Yes, it's much scarier, however, when he's a president dealing with countries rather than real estate competitors in New York. Nonetheless, he does it all the time. He's done it for years, and the tactic often works for him. As Jed Babin put it in a column titled, "From Outrage to Agreement, Trump's Greenland Gambit, What a Difference a Week Makes." Trump's U-turn included dropping his demand to own Greenland, dropping the tariff threats, and explicitly disavowing military force to acquire Greenland. All part, ladies and gentlemen, of the art of making his deal. Surviving the worst of Donald Trump's behavior, not unlike surviving brutal weather, requires proper conditioning, a lot of layers. But in the meantime, it isn't pleasant. In fact, sometimes it can be downright frightening. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHTY-AM in West Palm Beach, Florida, WYLF-AM in Peñon, New York, along with WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.